Hey, it's Francis Lamb, host of The Splendid Table. Every week on our show, we talk about food and cooking and the meanings of food and cooking. We talk with the most interesting people in food about their techniques, their culture, and everything in between. Whether it's about how fried chicken took over the world or how Instagram changes the way people are actually eating. It's a food show where everyone is welcome. Come join us. You can listen to The Splendid Table wherever you get your podcasts.
This program is brought to you by Chefs Collaborative, a nonprofit with a mission to inspire, educate, and celebrate chefs and food professionals building a better food system. Change menus, change lives. Learn more at chefscollaborative.org.
Thank you for listening to Heritage Radio Network. We are a member-supported nonprofit food radio station. That means that every single thing we do, from broadcasting 35 weekly shows for free, to bringing you exclusive content from sold-out food events across the country, to offering scholarships to high school students, is only possible thanks to the support of our loyal members. And we want you to join the club. Become a member during our 2017 summer drive to get access to sweet swag and pledge your support to the world's only food radio station. Visit heritageradionetwork.org/donate to become a member now.
Hey, this is Greg from Snacky Tunes. We are bringing you a very special live episode taped at Northside Festival earlier in June. One quick note, we reference a live performance by the band O at the end of the podcast. Unfortunately, the audio didn't capture. So instead, Gabby from the band sent us a few tunes to play throughout the show so you can hear the band in all their glory. Thanks for listening, and a big thank you to Lunabar and TNT for making this all happen. If you like the podcast, please subscribe at Snacky Tunes over at iTunes or wherever you get your podcasts, and give us a review if you feel up for it. Now sit back, listen, and enjoy this very special edition of Snacky Tunes Live.
We talk about food. We talk about music. With musical dudes, finger on the pulse, Snacky Tunes.
Wish I could love you less like great mantis. Rip your head off every time it starts to feel right. Wish I could love you less. Just love that's it.
welcome to Snacky Tunes. I'm one half your host, Greg Bresnitz. If you're just tuning in for the first time and hearing us, please make sure to go to iTunes and subscribe to the Snacky Tunes podcast. We're super excited to be coming to you today from Northside Festival. Thank you to TNT and Luna Bar for making this all possible. We have a live performance and interview with the band O later in the show, but first up, Chef Palak Patel. Hi. Welcome to Snacky Tunes.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
You got your start as a personal chef, which is a really interesting path. How did you fall into personal chefing? Because I've gone over and cooked food for friends, but no one's ever been like, please let me give you money for your services.
I didn't start as a personal chef. I like to cook. I thought I could cook. And I was actually working in a full-time marketing job and thought, hey, cooking's kind of fun. This would be a nice gig. My parents had a different opinion. It was like, hey, I think I want to go back to culinary school. And they were like, no, not happening. You keep working on your desk job.
What was the what were you marketing?
Neuroscience, actually.
Okay.
Yeah. Yeah.
As one does.
As one does.
There are a number of chefs that have very, very incredibly high pressure, super smart backgrounds, and they're like, forget this.
Yeah.
We just want to cook.
I just want to cook.
So did you get into personal chefing as a bridge gap between going back to culinary school?
Yeah, so I was looking to going back to culinary school, and it was quite a financial and a time commitment at that time. So I decided, hey, what's another avenue that I can just cook and be in what I love to do? And there was an association that certified personal chefs in San Francisco. I'm like, this is great. I did a month-long training, you know, did the certification and picked up a couple of clients just on my free time. And it ended up being a really successful part-time gig. So I kept doing it with the intent that once the company that I was working for got acquired, I would actually get back to culinary school full-time and pursue my dream.
What are some of the key insights for being a personal chef? Because it's really different than running your own kitchen. What are some of the things that you've had that you maybe struggled with early on that you learned was a turnaround to being a good ingredient for success?
I think for me personally, one of the struggles was just working in a team environment in a corporate setting to all of a sudden being alone. Hmm. And that to me was a big transition because I worked in cross-functional teams. I had clients and, you know, coworkers around the globe to when you have a question, it's you and that's it. So that transition from a team environment to a solo, like you're making all the decisions, was a kind of a challenging thing for me. But then instead, it works out. And, you know, you don't have to deal with all of the pressures of the team environment. And you get to do whatever you want. Came later.
What were some of your standout dishes that they said, chef, please, please make this for us? What stood out above the rest?
I think my fried chicken, obviously.
Which was delicious. The frittata bite was actually my favorite, but the fried chicken obviously is a crowd
pleaser. I grew up in Atlanta, so if I can't make fried chicken, I think they would kick me out.
Don't tell us your entire secret, but what's the key secret for your
fried chicken?
For your fried chicken.
I fry it twice.
Great answer. Perfect answer. That's correct.
Yeah.
So the fried chicken and any other dishes that you have taken with you from your personal chef days that still show up on your menu?
Lamb burgers. I know a lot of people have aversion to lamb. Indian culture has a lot of lamb, so I think it's really interesting when I actually make something that people are really averse to. And they're like, oh my God, I like lamb. I didn't know I like lamb.
Right.
Yeah.
I feel people the same way about rabbit, too.
Yeah.
Where they don't know
just the other white meat.
I don't think that's how that
kidding.
Works. but I think when my brother and I were really young, my mom sat us down for dinner and we're like, what are you having? She said, just try it and then I'll tell you. And we tried it. It was great. She said it was rabbit and then there were some tears and then we ate some more.
Yeah.
So, but that's the only way she could get us to do
that's
it.
That's it. You were already eating it. What are you going to do?
Either go hungry or have a second bite.
Right.
One of the things I'm curious about for being a personal chef versus being in a kitchen is the concept of ego, right? If you're running a 40-top restaurant, obviously you might have to play on pricing and, you know, people coming in, supply and demand, but you can put out your own food, your point of view. I feel, and correct me if I'm wrong, that being a personal chef is almost egoless. You have to be able to cook, obviously, but they're hiring you to execute food for them in a certain way.
Right. I think one of the biggest differences between a kitchen and being a personal chef is the factor that you really don't know what environment you're going to get into, right? So every kitchen is different, every event is different, and you just need to be able to be flexible and adaptable to that environment and execute the best that you know. And I think if you have a lot of ego and if you're very rigid into working with those environments and not be flexible with everyone that's around you, I don't think that you can work in this environment. And that's where I think personal chefing for me is great, because you really just have to kind of roll with the punches and get in there, and you have a vision of what you want to do. Something breaks or something isn't what you want, and then you make plan B or plan C, and you're still going to put out great food. I think that is the ultimate goal. Just because it doesn't look like how it looked like in your conceptual plans doesn't mean that it isn't a great dish.
What is the worst cooking setup you've been handed?
Worst cooking setup that I've been in. I think I did a pop-up in Miami, and I'm pretty sure I almost walked out. I was like, I can't.
Was it just a one burner?
Well,
no cold storage.
There's a lot of factors with the one burner we can do with. There's a lot of things that chefs can work around. And then there are certain environments like cleanliness. There's like, you know, there's things that I think we just don't want to deal with. Spaces, I think living in New York is something that you're used to, and you can work out of a shoebox if needed.
Sure.
And, you know, that's...
I can only you're being so polite, I can only imagine. When we're done with the interview, you can tell me off mic.
Okay.
So you went to French culinary in New York, and then you went to the south of France.
Yes.
What were some of the lessons that... Did you feel that you had to relearn anything from being a personal chef and being taught in a certain way and then going into a very, you know, classic, strict regimen? Did you feel that there were internal things you had to change or adjust to, or was it just a continuing of education?
To be very honest, I grew up vegetarian, so going to south of France was a challenge in just my personal skill to challenge myself to learn how to cook proteins, right? French training is a lot of rabbit, lamb, you know, pork, and these things they were not a part of my diet growing up. So going to France was just to learn kind of how they celebrate those things and really how they celebrate local ingredients that go along with that. So, yeah, the learning for me was, oh, okay, so I now know how to make foie gras terrine, and I know how to carve a duck, and I know how to make, you know. So these are the things that I didn't grow up with, which is why I went to France, because it's completely opposite of how I grew up. And it was a challenge for me personally.
How many times did you have to cook protein before you felt you got the hang of it? And what was the protein that you first mastered felt comfortable sending out to someone for someone to eat?
Chicken. Everybody, you know, chicken. It's like
okay.
Chicken.
Besides chicken. You put chicken in the oven for 45 minutes.
Yeah,
like, you're generally
it
good.
Can probably take itself out. I think rack of lamb.
Oh.
Rack of lamb.
That is a very big step up from chicken.
Right.
That's
quite
the jump.
Well, it was one of these things where, you know, someone asks you, hey, I'm doing a dinner, I want you to do something fancy, and you're like, okay, well, you know, you respect French chefs a lot, and it's like, you know, to the untrained chef, let me do rack of lamb, and then you're like, you know, Googling everything in between before you actually understand, and yeah, so the rack of lamb was probably one of those.
That's a very good answer.
Yeah.
So you've come back. And you started to do a couple dinner series with Dinner Lab, RIP, unfortunately. But what did you bring back from the south of France, from going back to getting your education and your personal chef, that began to define the style of cooking that you present to diners?
So the first Dinner Lab that I did in New York was really just to pay homage to my childhood. I love street food. I've eaten street food in so many countries. And one of my favorite memories were just going around in India when I was growing up and sneaking out and eating on the streets where I wasn't allowed to. And so...
What would you eat?
Pani puri.
Mm. We can stop there, but I want to hear some more.
Yeah.
But what else?
So, but that's one of those things where you're just like, as a kid, standing and they're just handing you, and it never stops.
Right.
And so I thought my first dinner series to introduce myself and my background would be Indian street food. Kind of a little amplified, but still to the truest of how I remembered it. And then I kind of took a turn on the other dinners that I did. So I did dinners across the country from, you know, New York all the way to San Francisco to Atlanta and Miami and D.C. I tried to find things that really define me. So one of the most interesting things that I learned living in south of France was France occupied India for 300 years, south of France in Pondicherry. And so that was fascinating to me. I had no idea. So when I went to Bangalore, we were driving through the coast, and the architecture looked very familiar and French. Lo and behold, I look it up, and I understand that they were there for 300 years along with the British. And so the second series of dinners that I did was a 17th century French-Indian dinner. So
wow. What did you serve?
Just a classic blend of what was available in the region, because that's what French would have found. A lot of seafood, but with a lot of flavors that were very quintessential to South India. So curry leaves, mustard seeds. So we did like a soft shell fried crab, like classic French techniques with ingredients that were found in south of India.
This sounds like a perfect restaurant idea.
Yeah, but I got one more.
Okay.
I did the third series was to growing up in Atlanta, which was grits and bubbles, or bubbles and grits, as you had fried chicken today. That's the other thing that defines me is growing up in Atlanta. I love grits, collard greens, fried chicken, macaroni and cheese. So I thought how great it is to marry champagne, which is very French and so bourgeois, to something so down and dirty as like French chicken or fried chicken. So we did French champagne and fried chicken.
Fantastic.
Yeah.
I'm sure that people left like very delirious and probably had like a very terrible next day of just a hangover and delicious memories. And you just went to Mexico City.
Yes.
Which I went to the first time a month ago.
That's
and I'm going
great.
Back in
Where
a
are
month.
You going?
Just to Mexico City because
okay.
we didn't I ran out of room in my stomach.
I know the feeling.
But again of your street vendor, I mean it was also because I didn't understand. Every corner I thought, well, this is the last street vendor I'm going to find. So I ate too much. And then I realized, oh, I wasn't patient.
You have to put yourself on a two-hour eating schedule.
Yes.
So you eat every 2 hours.
Yes.
Only a like small meal, not a full meal, because you don't know what's around the corner.
Right.
So, and you have to go to Oaxaca.
Yes, of course, for the mezcal.
And
the cheese and everything.
And the food.
And the
food in Oaxaca is world class, and I'm going to tell you, I wish I'd spent more time there.
Really?
So I would highly recommend you adjust your time.
I mean, it's not hard to convince
I'm
either my brother
you.
Or I to change a schedule for food.
Yeah.
So what was the one highlight or the best discovery that you found in the whole trip that you feel you're going to come back and try to incorporate or just have like the best food memory of all time?
Tlacoyas.
What is that?
So I was walking down the street in Coyoacan, which is the old neighborhood in Mexico City, and there are a ton of street vendors, but one in particular was like, literally, it felt like a freeway stop, like cars just whizzing by, except there were people. And I'm like, what is happening here? So I make my way through the crowd, and there's this massive, like, griddle, and they're making these, like, purple football-shaped tortilla-looking things, right? And I'm like, what is that? So luckily for me, I was with a friend that works for NPR. So I'm like, I have a translator slash, you know, cultural. And I'm like, what is that? And he's like, those are tlacoyas, which is purple corn. And they make them into a little pita bread type of thing. And they hollow it out. And you can get cactus, meat, refried beans. But the best part is the 7 buckets of salsa that accompany it. That you can just, like, eat your heart's desire.
And that's real spice.
For a dollar.
For a dollar.
For a dollar.
A dollar. You're going to have to draw a map for me where this is.
I'm going to show you pictures, and you're going to find that street corner, and you're going to go have tlacoya at that stand. It blew my mind.
Best food recommendation we've ever had on the show.
Blew my mind.
Well, Chef, I want to thank you for your time. Where can people find you? Where can they read your blog, which is great? Where can they get you?
Chef Pollock, and my website's chefpollockpatel.com. I write about my travels, and I post everything on Instagram and Facebook, etc.
Oh, yeah. What's your Instagram game like?
Chef Pollock.
Chef Pollock. It's great. Well, thank you for joining us. We're going to take a quick musical break, and then we'll be back with an interview with O, and followed by a live full performance later on the show.
Keep eating.
We'll be right back. Welcome back. We have Gabby Smith of O, who just played a really great set.
Thank you.
We're coming to you live from Kinfolk, part of Northside Festival. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
So you're a proper born and raised New Yorker.
That is true.
Which is a very rare breed.
Thank you.
Well, I mean, not many people that you meet. A lot of people came from somewhere. Like, I came from Philly, which is where you went to school at. And Philly was amazing. You were there 2008?
Yeah.
Pretty good time to be in Philadelphia.
Yeah, it was a very, I feel like, advanced musical moment in Philadelphia where everybody was making really freaky music and it was really inspiring and cool.
Where would you play or where would you go see music when you were there?
I played a lot at this place called the Danger Danger Gallery, which was in West Philly, and it is not there anymore.
I mean, none of the places are there anymore.
Well,
most of the places. Like, I grew up going to 4040 Club Rotunda, which don't... You're just looking at me blankly.
Yeah.
Right. Yeah, no, that's how far removed they are.
Yeah.
Yeah, okay. So you played at Danger Danger Gallery.
Yeah. And, yeah, that was kind of mostly the spot that...
Who were some of the other bands that you had played with?
Well, I was in a band called Power Animal. Which is still a band. I'm just not in it anymore.
Amicable?
Different. Oh, yeah, yeah. We're like BFF. It's totally cool. And there was this band at the time called Hermit Thrushes that was, like, really, really special to me. And this band called Snowcaps. A lot of really, really sick bands at the time.
I mean,
to list them all would be impossible.
We've got 10 hours. It's a podcast. We have
all right,
all
here
time.
We go.
Here we go. Alphabetical, but starting with Z and going that
cool.
way. But what's amazing is that a lot of your current collaborators you met in Philly back at that time.
No. Well,
no?
It was at that time, but I met them here.
Oh.
Yeah. They all actually also grew up in New York.
So a lot of New Yorker. I was a Philadelphia kid who got out, went to New York. You're a New Yorker who went to Philly for
yeah.
a couple of years and then came back.
Yeah.
What were some of the differences you can paint between the Philadelphia music scene and the New York, Brooklyn DIY scene?
Well, I had no idea what was going on in the New York scene at all. To me, it seemed like it was all like the Strokes and bands that sounded like the Strokes. And I was just like, that sucks. I don't sound like that, so bye. But now I think it's sick. I wish I had been part of it. But in Philly, it was like everybody was really mad at guitar. They were all trying to either like deconstruct what a guitar should sound like or make a band that had no guitars at all. And I thought that was like really hot and cool.
Who's a good example or one or two examples of bands that were able to fully deconstruct the guitar?
Deconstruct was definitely the band Hermit Thrushes. They just made this like really scary, just really like really weird music. Yeah.
So you formed the artist collective, the Epoch. What year did you form that in, and what was the scenario among you and your artist friends that were going on that led you to lead to creating that?
It was kind of just, I don't know, the Epoch is kind of a weird subject. We didn't really have any, it wasn't like, we're going to form this thing. It was just like, we don't fit in anywhere, and we want a place to show each other our music and make it feel like official, and you know, so we tried. We just made our own sort of inward-facing collective, but it doesn't work. So no,
Why doesn't
it
work?
I don't know. People just get bummed out. They're like, "Am I in it? Am I not in it? Like, what does it mean to be in it?" It's just like it does. It's not. It doesn't matter. It's not worth it.
Right. I mean, the barriers were of entry. It seems like just make something and then we'll tell people that you made something.
Yeah, exactly.
And people are like, but do I get a card? Do I get a button?
Right. Like, it was definitely cool because we felt like we had something to really, like, stand by. But then when we thought about it later, we were like, oh, we weren't really standing by anything. And that's cool, too. Like, we're just friends. Sick. You know what I mean?
You also did a really cool project where you wrote a song a day, mm-hmm. which I think is a really good creative push where by the time I go to bed, I'll have done mm-hmm. a song. And you worked with some really amazing bands mm-hmm. as well doing it. One of my favorites being Japanese Breakfast.
Oh, yeah.
I love that record so much.
Yeah.
And now that it's summer, I feel like it's a good summer,
yeah.
like romance record.
Totally. And some of those songs that are on Psychopomp were written during that Song a Day project.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Oh, that makes this even better.
Yeah.
So talk about the process, or what did you define as a completed song? What did it have to be recorded? Did it have to be written? Or what would your days be like?
At that time, I mean, it's kind of like, at the time, I think I was really blocked up creatively, and I just needed to let myself loose and try to allow anything to be a song that I felt was finished. So that was kind of the only criteria. Was like, all right, I've said what I need to say. It sounds audible, and here it is.
And we'll get to this in a point about your lyrics, but was it just the lyrics had to be complete, or there had to be some melody behind it, or
it had to be considered a song. So whatever that means. Create, you know, just if you hear it and you're like, oh, that's a song, like that's my criteria for.
And for you and the other bands that did it, would it be, you know, before you went to bed, you would send each other your songs, or how did, or was it just for you and they supported you, or was everyone writing in that period?
We had a Tumblr where we would post, each person had access to the Tumblr, and we would just post the song, and then I think each of us would, like, reblog it on our own Tumblrs. There was, like, a May5to12songs.tumblr.com was what it was. I'm sure it's still there.
Say again, May 5?
May 5 to 12
Are the
songs.
Five spelled out? Or
no,
they,
just okay. The numbers, yeah. You have to do a little Googling, probably.
That's fine. We can get there. We're a modern show. When did you feel, from the beginning of the song a day process, till how long was it till you felt that you were able to unstick your writer's block, or felt, okay, this has served its purpose, and now I'm going to go and just write my next record?
I think that exercise showed me that, for me, songwriting is this muscle that I can just engage whenever I need to. Like, for example, last week I was upstate by myself, and I wrote 2 songs a day, and thought, I was just like, I wonder if I can write 2 songs a day, what would that be like? And it was really easy. I don't know.
Did you find that the first song or the second song, was either of them stronger, or there was no pattern to which?
It depended on the day. Some days I'd wake up and just be like, no, I don't want to do this at all. I just want to, like, go lay on the couch. And then that song would be worse. And then after I would listen to it and be like, okay, I did it, then I would be able to make a second song that's usually stronger, or vice versa.
Oh, so you would, or if you got up and you were inspired, you'd be like, oh, that's easy. And the yeah. second song would be...
would be like, you know, a little bit more experimental or whatever.
What I really love about your music is the lyrics. They're really beautiful. Some of them I can't quite figure out. Some of them I can understand. But you've talked about in the past about how your lyrics come first, they're mixed mm-hmm. first, and everything's built around it. Where did you find that process? A lot of people who are solo artists will sometimes say it's the music first, and then I figure it out. But how did you land on lyrics being the center of this project?
Most of my writing takes place when I'm in private, and most of the times that I'm in private are times when I'm in transit. And I think that you can do whatever you want on the subway, but I don't feel comfortable being like taking out my guitar and trying to figure out some.
You would be the definition of that person.
Yeah, exactly.
You're like, oh, okay, cool.
Exactly.
That's so, like going and writing a novel in a coffee shop.
Exactly. It's just like you're that guy, like, cool. So I just take my phone or my notebook or whatever is my thing of the moment, and just try as hard as I can to organize my thoughts when I'm alone. And usually it just comes out. I think of it in a more sing-songy way, so it just comes out in a way that works lyrically. But often I have to, like, add and cut lyrics in the actual song.
Is there a particular train line that's really good for writing songs?
The Bolt Bus to Philadelphia is, like, the best writing space of all time.
Why is that?
It's just so, like, you. No matter where you're sitting, you can just, like, tuck away in a corner and just, like, scribble and feel like you're making a lot of progress because you're, like, moving forward and you know where you're going and you're above ground and you can, like... I love the thesaurus. I use it a lot. I still have access to my thesaurus on the Bolt Bus.
Is there a song that you can tell us that you wrote on the Bolt Bus that made it onto one of your records?
I definitely wrote Broken Necks on the Bolt Bus.
We'll have to just, like, imagine, like, the Schuylkill River and the boathouses
exactly.
rushing by on mm-hmm. that. So you are going to play a couple festivals this summer.
Yeah. We're playing the Hopscotch Festival in North Carolina, and then the Simple Things Festival. Well, that's in October, but we're playing the Simple Things Festival in Bristol.
Amazing.
Yeah.
Are you excited?
Yeah. It's going to be cool.
Have you been to Bristol?
No.
Okay.
Yeah.
So if any of you listeners have any Bristol food tips, please send to us.
Yeah, please help us. Or like where we should sleep would be cool too.
I'm sure people can figure that out.
Yeah, you know.
Well, we want to make sure that we have time because we're going to play the entire concert you just performed for us. So anything people should have in the mindset before they listen to you rip for 40 minutes?
It's really good, and this is a particularly good show that we just played for you in a minute.
Oh, so we captured a good moment in time.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, where can people find you? help you get a place to sleep in Bristol, get bulk butts tips.
Yeah, we're on Facebook and Bandcamp.
Love Bandcamp.
Yeah.
They're so good.
It's a good one.
They're really good. Well, I want to thank Chef Patel for being on the show. I want to thank Northside, Luna, and TNT for having us. We're going to be right back with a full concert from O. Thanks for listening. We're Snacky Tunes. We'll be back next week with another live episode.
Bye.
Great. That's great. Perfect. Yeah.
Screamed out, how did it get this bad? And the thunder.
We talk about food. We talk about music with musical dudes. Finger on the pulse, Snacky Tunes.
Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. For our freshest content and to hear about exclusive events, subscribe to our newsletter. Enter your email at the bottom of our website, heritageradionetwork.org. Connect with us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter at heritage_radio. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization driving conversations to make the world a better, fairer, more delicious place. And we couldn't do it without support from listeners like you. Want to be a part of the food world's most innovative community? Rate the shows you like, tell your friends, and please join our community by becoming a member. Just click on the beating heart at the top right of our homepage. Thanks for listening.
Hey, everybody. I'm Nick Layton.
And I'm Leah Bonema.
And we're the hosts of Were You Raised by Wolves?
Each week, we try to make the world a kinder, nicer place.
Well, that's the idea, at least.
I mean, we try.
Have you ever wondered what to do if you're ghosted?
Or what to do when a friend asks you to borrow money?
Or the proper way to eat Cheetos?
You know, the big questions.
So please find Were You Raised by Wolves wherever you listen.